This is the Bob McCown Podcast, yours truly, along with John Shannon, as per usual.
Hello, Robert.
Hello, Shenny. Well, the Toronto Maple Leafs go against the up against the Chicago Blackhawks, who couldn't win an inter-squad game right now. No. And I guess, as the hockey resident hockey puck here,
you? Oh.
Well, definitely not me.
Oh.
Are these Blackhawks as bad as they appear, or are they just playing poorly?
Yes. well, first of all, they've been ripped through with COVID from an on-ice perspective. I mean, Jonathan Toews, Patrick Kane, they have COVID issues. That's one thing. They missed certain players that were dominant players for them for a long period of time, like Duncan Keith, who's now at Edmonton. And they seem to have a disconnect with their coach. That said, in Chicago, I don't think we can avoid it. Their on-ice performance is the least of the worries for the Chicago Blackhawks right now, because of the investigation of sexual abuse and the results that were revealed publicly yesterday afternoon.
And that investigation is apparently ongoing, and a couple of high-profile former Blackhawk members, their former head coach and former AGM, was Cheveldayoff off the AGM?
Yes, he was.
Have scheduled meetings with Gary Bettman. What do you expect to come from that?
Well, without, you know, reading the commissioner's mind, but knowing full well what has gone on in Chicago, and how the Blackhawks are trying to separate themselves from this situation, and have basically the company has pled guilty to the abuses. I would suggest that both Cheveldayoff and Quenneville will get punished at some point, at some way. I don't think they can be ignored, and I would not be surprised that there's some level of suspension for both of them coming up. And that's just my personal opinion. Bottom line is, Bob, in the meeting that they had in 2010 with the senior management group, everybody agreed that the president and CEO of the company was going to handle it. He did not handle it. They allowed it to go on for more than 3 weeks. And that's wrong. And it was disgraceful, and it should be dealt with.
I don't disagree with anything you said, other than wondering, you know, if, and it's my understanding of the situation is the same as yours, that the senior group met, it was understood that the president at the time was going to deal with these things. Mm-hmm. He did not deal with them for a period of about 3 weeks.
Correct.
Waited until after the Stanley Cup playoffs were over, and the Blackhawks had won a Stanley Cup, by the way. How does that implicate Quenneville and Cheveldayoff there is an agreement, there's an understanding that the president is going to deal with it. For anybody else in the organization, you kind of go, okay, well, he's going to deal with it.
I'll tell you what
wrong did they do is, I guess, is the question I'm asking. Well, I'm not trying to defend them by any stretch.
No,
I just don't
I
understand.
Think that's fair. This is not a hockey issue.
Clearly,
this is not a business issue of an internal nature. This is sexual abuse, and this is criminal. This is criminal, and at that point, you no longer are an employee. You are a member of society. You have to be responsible. The least of which, Bob. The least which what Joel should have done. If he was aware of everything that had gone on, and according to the report that was revealed yesterday, he should have said, "I don't want that guy around my club. I don't want that guy around my people, and we should suspend him. We should suspend him indefinitely, and then do an investigation." But not only did they not do that, Bob, they allowed him to celebrate and be involved with the Blackhawks in their Stanley Cup win. They allowed him to get a Stanley Cup ring, and they allowed him to have his name on the Stanley Cup and have a day with the Stanley
Cup
in his hometown.
Yeah.
That is disgraceful.
There's no doubt about that. I would never argue that for a second. again, and
listen, we're in a world of whistleblowers, Bob.
Yeah, I know.
We're in a world of whistleblowers. Somebody has to stand. Who's standing up and who stood up for John Doe? John Doe 1 and John Doe 2. Who stood up for them? And the answer is nobody. And they have to be held responsible for not standing up for these two people. The player and the intern were treated poorly. We're ignored by the organization, and the Blackhawks should be embarrassed. They should be ashamed, and something should be done.
Can't disagree with a word you've said. What would you anticipate would happen to Quenneville and Cheveldayoff?
I think suspension. I think that the league will, again, my personal opinion, I'm not going to be party to the conversation, but I think that both Kevin and Joel should be and will be suspended for a period of time.
An extended period of time? I mean, the situation is not light. If you concur with John's assessment, and I tend to,
well, then not
the suspension
that,
should be considerable.
Not only that, Bob, and here's just a fact of what happened yesterday. By the Blackhawks admitting guilt and the civil suits that are still ongoing, we are talking the punitive nature of the Blackhawks with their admission of guilt of having to pay, you know, I think tens of millions of dollars. Tens of millions of dollars in retribution to everybody involved, the high school player, the intern, and the former Blackhawk Black Ace.
The conversation about this subject obviously will continue as information continues to come out and decisions are made by the National Hockey League specifically on the futures of the coach in Florida and the general manager now in Winnipeg, both of whom were on the staff in Chicago in 2010 at the time of the incidents. We'll take the break. Game one of the World Series last night, and we'll address that on this program. Dan Shulman, who is doing radio play-by-play of the World Series and is one of the voices of the Toronto Blue Jays, will join us after these messages. McCown and Shannon back with you. Dan Shulman. Voice of the Blue Jays, voice of the World Series on radio in the U.S., joining us from the Deep South, where there is a weather warning. And so if Shulman appears to you slightly concerned or looking over his shoulder, or if all hell breaks loose in the middle of this podcast, you'll know that there's a tornado warning, correct?
Yes. Yeah. It's about 8:30 this morning local time. My phone had that screeching sound to it, one that I've always associated with Amber Alerts, the same kind of noise that it makes. And I picked up my phone and it said tornado warning. And I read the whole tornado warning and it didn't even say, I mean, my phone knows I'm in Houston, but I'm not smart enough to know that my phone knows I'm in Houston. So I read the whole thing and I said, well, it doesn't know I'm in Houston. And then I clicked on my weather app and it defaulted to Toronto for some reason. And it said like cloudy and 14 or whatever. And I said, boy, there must be some kind of a mistake. And then I went, hey, dummy. And I went down to Houston and it said 25 degrees tornado warning. So yeah, you take that stuff kind of seriously down here because I'm sure they've been through it
as well,
or twice. But the worst seems to have passed, knock on wood, and I think we're okay.
Well, game one was certainly interesting from a whole variety of perspectives. And I want to there's a couple things that I want to kind of focus in on. Morton gets whacked in the second inning.
In the second inning, yes.
Second inning, lower part of his leg with a line drive, and they wind up getting the out. He comes back and pitches in the next inning too, and then leaves, and we find out he has a fracture of his lower leg. And you know, look at much was made of this and the, I don't know whether bravery is the right word, but the inclination of him to stay out there. And I do admire that, but clearly the pain was, he thought the pain was going to be tolerable. And obviously that only lasted a fairly brief period of time. Have you seen anything of this sort before?
No, I mean, the one thing I thought of being Canadian is kind of Bobby Bond way, 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 way back in the day, right?
Well, yeah, with a broken leg, playing on a broken leg.
But same thing. It was a fracture, a hairline fracture, just like where I think we see with Martin.
Yeah. So the interesting part was when the injury happened, the trainer didn't come out, the manager didn't come out. Right. Morton waved them off and said, I'm fine. And listen, unfortunately, pitchers get hit by comebackers a lot. And most of the time, they're okay. And he threw, I believe, 10 more pitches in the second inning, came off the field. And that was the last we thought of it, to the point that when it happened, after he struck out Altuve, and then he kind of bent over, I wondered, did he like trip on his follow through on his pitch? Did he catch a spike or something, twist an ankle? I had forgotten about the comebacker because it didn't appear like it was a thing. And what I don't know, and maybe they know, maybe they don't, is, you know, did he fracture it in the moment, or was it stressed enough? And then on the follow through on the last pitch to Altuve, did that further the injury? And that, because he went from not showing any pain at all, really, to having to come out of the game. And
the only thing, sorry to interrupt. The only thing was, and I maybe you weren't privy to this, but the shot of him in the dugout, he did put his jacket on, which doesn't necessarily mean anything for a starting pitcher between innings, but then did go into the clubhouse. And it was assumed by the television crew at the time that he was done for the night, and then came back into the dugout and went back, as you said, went back out to pitch.
Yeah. What we found out later was he got an x-ray at that time. He got an x-ray before he came back out for the third inning. And the x-ray at that point, if I'm connecting the dots properly, the x-ray was negative. So again, whether it just missed something or whether the bone was stressed or stressed, I guess would be the right word. And then it cracked on that pitch to Altuve, but he immediately reacted when he threw that pitch to Altuve. And Charlie Morton, I talked to Brian Snicker, the manager of the Braves, yesterday about Morton. Everything he said about Morton, you could have put those words into Charlie Montoyo's mouth about Marcus Semien. Like, he's that guy. He's the guy everybody reveres. He's the best teammate. He's the lead by example guy. He's, you know, humble, self-deprecating, everything like that. So, I mean, you know, you don't want this for anybody, but it really kind of breaks my heart for this guy's almost 38 years old. He's won a World Series and he's been in a few, but he's almost 38. And he's the kind of guy that even if you don't have an emotional stake in his team, you kind of pull for him. And I'm really sad to see this happen to him.
So what does this mean to the rotation for the Braves?
Well, it means they're in about as equal as much of a mess as the Astros are. They're both messed up right now, but so they've got Drew Smyly, who's been at times a starter, at times a reliever in his career. He'll factor in somehow. And they actually made one change on the roster. Kyle Wright, who has been a starter at AAA for them, pitched a little bit in the playoffs for them last year, but spent most of this year at AAA, but as a starter and pitched extremely well. They put him on the roster anyways, wanting a little bit more length. So they're covered. They're just not covered with the quality that they would get in Charlie Morton. But again, objectively, even with this, they might be in better shape than Houston. So Houston doesn't have Lance McCullers, who'd kind of be their Charlie Morton equivalent. He didn't pitch in the last round either. And Framber Valdez has been great or terrible, nothing in between in the playoffs. And if it's the terrible version of Valdez that shows up again in game five for Houston, they've got a real problem because they don't have Max Fried. Atlanta still got Max Fried. It's amazing. We all can remember the days where before a playoff series, you knew who was starting 1 and 5. You knew who was starting 2 and 6. You knew who was starting 3 and 7. And you had a pretty good idea who was starting 4. Those days are long gone.
Well, I was just going to go down that road. And, you know, we've had plenty of discussions, the three of us and John and I ourselves, about the way
bullpen starts,
starting pitchers, how they're used. And what we're seeing now, I mean, we went through all of our lives, essentially, as you depicted, saying, okay, who are the three guys that are going to get 2 starts in every 7-game series? And then you probably have to have one more, unless you got somebody pitching on 3 days rest.
Right.
Right. And at most, you needed 4 starters, at most, and maybe even 3. And now you need 50.
But as a kid, I mean, not to be an old fogey about this, but to me, so many World Series were defined by those pitchers.
Of course, they
defined,
were.
I mean,
completely.
I've never forgotten Mickey Lolich's name because of Mickey Lolich and his starts.
Sure.
For the Tigers, ever.
Jack Morris.
Bob Gibson.
Sure. Sandy Koufax, but even Jack Morris. Dave Steeb in the 7-game series against Kansas City, the American League Championship Series, started 1-4-7. Now, if he had started 1-5, maybe the Blue Jays would have won the World Series because they would have had a more, who knows. But are people 30 years from now going to talk about Tyler Matzek? As great as Matzek has been in relief, you know, but it is, to me, something has been lost in terms of the star power of the starting pitcher. I you know, back when newspapers were a thing, I'd open up the newspaper and say, oh, it's Steve and Clemens or right. Steve and Morris and it's Smoltz and whoever. Like, that was something to get excited about. And that doesn't happen anymore. And I get it. Like, I understand analytics. As you guys both know, I've got a heavy, hardcore math background, statistics and actuarial science and all that stuff. I'm not afraid of numbers. I like numbers. But I do think the pendulum has swung a little bit too far. And I don't think the product is as pleasing and the product moves much slower now. Is it smarter? Sure. Yeah, maybe. But I still would love to see the emphasis of the starting pitcher increased. And not to get us all sidetracked here, but if the DH is universal next year, there is some discussion that the DH will be tied to the starting pitcher, as in when the starting pitcher comes out of the game, you lose your DH. And then you've got to use pinch hitters or have the pitchers hit the rest of the way. And that's one kind of way to circumvent what's happening now and to try to encourage teams to leave their starting pitchers in longer. I don't know if it'll happen. And even if it does, I don't know.
I like that.
Yeah. Well, I like anything that achieves the objective that you stated, and that being to go back to an era where starting pitchers pitch and throw more than 70 pitches in a game and face a lineup for a third time or a fourth time even. It's never seemed problematic to me. And I think my sense of this is what we are seeing now are the unforeseen ramifications of this new era of thought process with regard to starting pitching and using your bullpen more. And, you know, the Tampa Bay scenario of using relievers to start games, designating a guy. Like, there are ramifications to this, offshoots of it. And they present themselves, of course, during the regular season, but we don't pay that much attention as a general rule. When you get to the World Series, we're watching everything.
Yeah.
And we're seeing these things now happen. Now, the Morton injury was separate. That was uncontrollable. But, of course, it would have been intriguing to see how long they left Morton in, even with a 5-0 lead, right?
I was going to say, by the time Morton even made his first pitch, that he was leading. So, I mean, that's the one advantage he had.
Well, think of it this way. If you're not comfortable in letting a guy face a lineup a third time through, and even somebody who's, here's a counter argument, even somebody as great as Robbie Ray, who is likely, in my opinion, to win the Cy Young Award this year, his opponent's OPS the first and second time through the order were like 550, 580. Like, great stuff. His opponent's OPS the third time through the order, I believe, was 930. That's a really good hitter. A 930 hitter is a really good hitter. And everybody was a 930 hitter OPS against Ray the third time through. And that's a guy who might win the Cy Young this year. But if you're not going to let a guy see a lineup the third time, so that's obviously 18 batters. So the most he can go is 6 innings. If he's perfect, he's going 6 innings. He'd have to be really close to perfect to even go 5 if he's not going to see the lineup the third time through. Now, some guys are exceptions to the rule. And the Blue Jays did let Robbie Ray do it for most of the season, even though they were obviously well aware of the numbers. When Hyunjin Ryu is at his best, the Blue Jays let him go. Like, there are exceptions to the rule. But one thing I've wondered, and I've asked about this, okay, so you bring in a reliever out of the bullpen in the 6th inning because that guy's got a better shot than the starting pitcher. But then you're having to use 4 relievers instead of 3, or 3 instead of 2, or 5 instead of 3. So now you're digging deeper into your pen. And eventually you're going to get to somebody who you don't really trust and you don't really want in a close situation. So like you were saying, Bob, there's a domino effect to this strategy. It's not just in the moment, who's better in this spot in the 6th inning. What if you go extra innings? What if the order comes around again in the 9th? You might be left with your 4th or 5th best reliever in the most important spot of the game.
Well, okay, so let me ask a question. I don't know whether you know the answer to this. Overall, were runs scored down this year?
I believe they were up, but I'm not 100% sure. Now, again, we had 162 instead of 60, and we had an extraordinary number of injuries this year, like an unprecedented number of injuries, and it impacted pitchers more than anybody else. It's a good question. I would have to look at that, but I don't think it was noticeably up or down. I think it was slightly up.
Well, again, what I'm trying to get at is it's very easy to isolate the stats that you quoted here, which are the same kinds of stats we hear all the time from proponents of this system. Yeah. What we don't hear is, okay, you're going to take a pitcher out and not let him face the lineup for the third time. And the statistics, historic statistics, bear out that decision. What are the numbers on the relievers that you bring in?
Yeah.
What are the numbers on that combination of, as you said, 2, 3, 5 guys? And are their numbers that much better than what you would anticipate from a starting pitcher?
Right.
Anecdotally, I would say I'm not seeing that.
Right. Is your fourth or fifth best reliever at his best better than your starting pitcher third time through? To me, that's what it comes down to. That might be the simplest way to say it. And I don't know the answer to that. That is beyond my abilities to compute that sort of thing. But again, it's not like this is being devised out of thin air. These are, you know, smart people with good degrees crunching numbers, but there is a human element of it too. But again, and, you know, people I talk to and respect, they will say he was dealing, Blake Snell or anybody else, he was dealing. Look at how good he looked. They will say there is zero correlation between look how good he looked the first two times through and look what he did the third time through. And they're crunching the numbers, not me. So it worked for Framber Valdez in Game 5 of the American League Championship Series. And Dusty Baker said he was dealing. I left him. I'm not going to take a guy out when he's pitching that well. But I think there's also a little bit of you tend to notice when whatever happens favors your side of the argument. Oh, look, he left Valdez in. They should leave a guy in. Whereas other people would say, well, look at how Robbie Ray got hit third time through the order. They should take him out. I think people tend to see the side of the argument that they're on in the first place.
So Morton gone. Who's got the better pitching staff and better bullpen right now?
I think Atlanta's got the better bullpen. And all four of the guy I like to say in the circle of trust. It's a very exclusive little company or little group in October. You've got to be in the circle of trust. Atlanta's got Brian Snitker's got four guys, the three lefties in Minter, Matzik, and Smith, and the righty in Jackson. They all pitched last night. Three of them pitched more than an inning, which is another very interesting thing to me because a lot of teams are kind of wired that all their relievers are one inning guys. And I think that's a fail. I think relievers need to be able to get up and down and should be able to throw. And if the first inning they get them on 8 pitches, go back out for another inning. I think that's something that relievers need to be able to do. You're not facing the same guys the second time around. You're only going to go out there for 6 outs maybe. So you shouldn't face anybody more than once if you're pitching well. But I think Atlanta's bullpen is better. Those lefties have been lights out for the most part for the Braves in the postseason. And I think they're a little bit stronger than Houston. And the best remaining starter, I think, also belongs to Atlanta in Max Fried. And Ian Anderson, their Game 3 guy, he's pretty good, but he's only gone 3 or 4 innings in his last couple of postseason starts. We are going to see a ton of pitching changes over the next however many games it lasts. But, you know, again, if you think that Houston is without McCullers, it's really amazing they shut down Boston as well as they did. But I think right now, even with the Morton injury, I still think Atlanta's got a slightly better pitching staff.
One of the intriguing stats about the Houston Astros is their apparent ineptness in the postseason at home. I think they've lost 5 in a row, Danny?
Yes.
At home.
In the World Series at home, yes.
Yeah, and won only 2 of 10. Explain that one, Lucy.
Well, you know what? So throw last year out because there were no fans and it was in a neutral park and all that. Okay. Overall, the home team has lost 10 straight World Series games. Game 1 last night. All 7 in 2019. We'll never see that again. The road team won all 7 games in the Washington-Houston World Series, and then the Red Sox won the last 2 at Dodger Stadium in 2018 to win the World Series. I have no explanation for it. I mean, historically, home field advantage in baseball has meant much less than football, basketball, or hockey. I don't know why. I have an opinion as to why. I think baseball has a much greater element of randomness to it than any other sport. If Yuli Gurriel hits the ball a 16th of an inch higher or lower than he does, Charlie Morton doesn't get hurt. You can get sawed off and flare it over the infield, or you can pop it up. Again, the difference is like a 16th of an inch or an eighth of an inch on the bat. I think there's a lot more chaos rampant in baseball than there is in other sports. So I think that's why I feel home field advantage isn't as significant. But it is strange because it's loud there. Like, their fans are good. And no team gets booed on the road more than Houston. So you'd think no team would be happier to be home than Houston. But that's one I don't have for you. I can't figure out the answer.
And when you think and you realize the rules of the designated hitter don't exist in the Atlanta games, you wonder how that affects things as well.
Well, I think Atlanta's got a built-in advantage here. And I think this is the last year we'll talk about it, because I think there will be a universal DH next season. But Atlanta, Alex Anthopoulos, as you guys know, acquired four outfielders at the trade deadline. They needed a bunch. He got four, and they're all pretty good. Right now, Eddie Rosario is doing an impersonation of a lot better than pretty good, but they're all pretty good. So on any given day, they have three in there and one off the bench, which is great in the National League. But in the American League park, they just have all four in there. Mm-hmm. And Jorge Soler, who led off the series with a home run, he's the DH. So I think Atlanta, they're very comfortable in their park, and they're very comfortable in the American League park. The Astros, to me, are at a disadvantage going to Atlanta. Dusty Baker's got a decision to make, and I think he's going to choose offense over defense. So I think he's going to have Alvarez in left field, where he's below average. I think he's going to move Michael Brantley from left to right, which, Brantley does not run all that well. His legs betray him. They're sore. He's got bad knees sometimes, and not a great arm. So I think moving him from left to right is a downgrade from Kyle Tucker, and Kyle Tucker moving from right to center is okay. But they're going to lose a little bit defensively in all three spots to keep their best lineup in there. And I think it's the right move. But I think in this particular World Series, the difference in the rules actually favors the National League team.
We want to talk about the Atlanta Braves and our friend Alex Anthopoulos and some of the things that he did, because I think there are people that should know exactly how this team actually got to where they are. We'll do that when we return with Dan Shulman after these messages. Bob McCown, John Shannon, Dan Shulman with you today. Our friend Alex Anthopoulos did something that he's done before. He did it here in Toronto in 2015. He essentially took a team that did not look like a playoff contender, did not look like a playoff team. I believe in both cases were below 500, and made dramatic moves in an effort to win, when I think most general managers would probably say, we're not in that place. To shake things up dramatically to try and win this year, too risky, too long-term. He did it. He did it again. And here he is in a World Series with this group. Hard to argue, Danny, that it wasn't the right decision, isn't it?
No, absolutely. And I believe July 30th, and the trade deadline was actually the 30th this year, not the 31st. I believe Atlanta was 51-55. Four games under 500. They had not at any point, not for one day at that point, been above 500 on the season. Not once. And they needed a brand new outfield. Ronald Acuna Jr. tore his ACL 2 days before the All-Star break. Marcelo Zuna has been out for months. Domestic violence issues, administrative leave. He hasn't played. And they weren't getting any offense out of center field. So they needed three. And Alex went and got four. And I think he was likely to do something. But I think what really empowered him, guys, is the division was so bad. The Mets were in the lead, I think, at the right time, but they're the Mets, and they weren't that far ahead. The Nationals weren't any good. The Marlins weren't any good. And the Phillies at the time looked like kind of what they are, which is a team that'll tease you, but in the end, not be good enough. They had too many flaws. And I think Alex saw a division that was there to be won. And I think Alex Anthopoulos believes, and I subscribe to this theory too, just get in. Because once you get in, anything can happen. It's great if you can get in by winning a division and you don't have to play in a wild card game. That's one extra step that you don't want to have to deal with, but just find a way to get in. And then some other things happened. Max Fried started pitching extremely well. The bullpen got better, but really it was the acquisition of those outfielders. I mean, I cannot think of anything close to replicating what Alex Anthopoulos did in trading for a brand new outfield plus one, at the trade deadline. And if he doesn't do it, I guess the Phillies would have won the division with like 83 wins or something like that. Atlanta wouldn't be here.
Biggest difference between now and 2015 is that Alex has more job security now. So,
I think the situation is different. There's, there's no question about that. The Blue Jays were in transition at the time, and the Braves aren't. So, and I also think Alex is one, like a lot of smart people, he is one to, you know, to learn from the past and assimilate his prior experiences and that sort of thing. And I think 2015, it was like a run differential thing. And they said, we're better than our record. I think 2021, there was a little bit of that, but it was also, hey, we don't have an outfield and the division kind of stinks and we can win this thing. So I think some of the parameters were different, but the end result, just as impressive.
Well, the other difference was he went out and got impact players, potentially impact players for the Toronto Blue Jays in 15, like Tulowitzki. Now, you don't know what that's going to mean at the end of the day. But they were moves where you raised a Spocky an eyebrow and said, oh, okay, maybe, you know, you had that bat, that glove, blah, 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 because it had problems at shortstop. These are just four guys that Alex got. I mean, good players, but not. Is there one guy there that was potentially impactful?
None of them is what I would call a star. Although no. Adam Duvall, you could win a hell of a bar bet on this. Adam Duvall led the National League in RBIs this year. 113 RBIs. Now, he did a lot of that for the Marlins before the trade, and he'd been with the Braves before. But I think they got – it would be the equivalent of going out and getting a Lourdes Gurriel and a Corey Dickerson and doing that again. He got two left-handed batters, two right-handed batters. He got four useful players. He didn't get stars, but he got useful players. Now, Rosario has played like a star, right? And Soler has played much better in Atlanta than he did in Kansas City. Jock Peterson has helped and Adam Duvall has helped. So they were four upgrades, but I think it was more the cumulative impact. Again, they were getting nothing out of their outfield. And the Acuna injury, you know, Acuna is one of the five best players in baseball. And he tears his ACL July 10th or whatever it is. And I remember, I don't remember where I was. I might have been getting ready to call a game in the studio when I found out. But I remember in the moment seeing that. And I remember my thought was, well, I don't know who's going to win the division now, but it's not Atlanta. They're done. You lose a player of that magnitude. So I think it wasn't about getting, you know, David Price, Troy Tulowitzki stars. I think it was just about getting enough good quantity of reasonably talented players to raise the floor. They weren't looking to, you know, build an addition above the ceiling. They were just looking to raise the floor. And those guys came in and they actually did more than that. And I also believe, and there's no way to prove this mathematically, I also believe those kinds of things really resonate in the clubhouse. And it really makes the players say, hey, they believe in us. They're giving us a shot to win.
You can, that's the one measure I see is that if somebody came from another country and watched the Braves play and watched them celebrate together and have a good time in the dugout, you'd think that they'd played together for 10 years.
Yes.
And that's amazing in a short term.
Yeah. And I do believe in chemistry. You know, it's the age old, does winning bring chemistry? Does chemistry bring winning? And it's obviously a little bit of both. But I was asked about this earlier this morning. And I do believe they have something a little bit above and beyond the typical team. And I'll be honest with you. I think the Blue Jays had it this year, too. You know, you guys watched a lot of Blue Jays games. Those 26 guys loved each other.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you talked, John, about it looked like they've been together 10 years. Alek Manoah had been on the team for 10 minutes, and it looked like he had been there for 10 years. I think the Blue Jays had great chemistry as well, and I think that served them well through their Dunedin, Buffalo, Toronto situation. But I think the Braves have it, and culture is a, you know, a word that gets thrown around, and it can become a cliche. But I do believe they've got an attitude of, well, heck, we've overcome this. Why can't we overcome that? And I think that's going to serve them well with respect to the Charlie Morton injury, too.
I'm going to throw you a curveball. What's your favorite Dusty Baker story?
Well, I'll tell you, on a goofy personal level, a lot of times when I see Dusty, he's a big college basketball fan, fan. So I'll walk into the room and sit down with him, and he'll just kind of look at me and he'll say, I've been watching you. I've been seeing you, because he watches a lot of college basketball.
That's good.
And I love that. I love Dusty. He is, I don't know if you guys have ever had a chance to meet him or talk to him or anything. Root for Dusty Baker, like you've got to evaluate yourself, I think. I mean, this guy's been through a lot. You know, he came up with the Atlanta Braves in the Deep South in the 1960s. That's a tough road. And Hank Aaron put his arm around him and said, "I got you, kid." And yeah. Dusty and Hank were lifelong friends after that until Hank passed away. So for Dusty to be in a World Series against Atlanta means something to him. But he gets to know his people. Before Game 6 of the American League Championship Series, he went around to three or four food stops, food just restaurants. He phoned in orders ahead. Some of his players, he knows what kind of food they like. This guy likes gumbo. This guy likes oxtails. This guy likes barbecue, whatever. And the manager's bringing in food at 1 p.m. for his players before the biggest game of their season. And for some of them, their careers. I think he cares about people a tremendous amount. He's had every life experience you can have. Nothing rattles him. And I just, every day before the game, our radio crew, the ESPN radio crew, we get to go in and sit in the office with him for 10 to 15 minutes and pick his brain. And we do, but we end up talking about all kinds of stuff that you couldn't anticipate talking about because he's got a story about everything.
And the knock was that he could not, as a manager, could not win the big game. And that was always the knock.
Yes. He's talked about his nemesis being Game 6, the Giants in 2002, the Cubs. He was the manager of the Cubs when Steve Bartman, the fan, touched the ball down the left field line. And I think Dusty has, I don't want to say grown, but adjusted in terms of, you know, how he, a lot of a manager, as you guys know, is almost totally based sometimes on your bullpen decisions. And it shouldn't be just based on your bullpen decisions. But, you know, he takes the analytics into him, but you can't ignore it. You don't get a job if you don't, listen to the guys with the analytics. But Dusty was brought into Houston not because of that. He was brought in because they were in the middle of a firestorm because of the cheating scandal, and they wanted somebody with big enough shoulders and a good enough touch to deflect attention away from the players. And who better than Dusty Baker to do that? Now, he's still... and Brian Snitker is the same way. He likes to leave his pitchers in a little bit longer. He likes to look in people's eyes and see what's in there. You know, he'll go out to the mound and talk to a pitcher and then decide if he's going to take him out of a game. Nobody does that
anymore. Not anymore.
But, yeah, Dusty can look into your eyes and see your soul. I really believe that. But I think he's, a little bit less feel, a little bit more numbers. He relies on his coaches. It's not like the old days where bench coaches didn't even exist. But I think he belongs in the Hall of Fame. Did he have a playing career that warrants it? No. He's a very good player, but not a Hall of Fame player. Right. But I think, and you don't get into the Hall of Fame on this basis. You get in as a player or a manager. But I think you should be able to get in based on what you've done for the sport. And I think when you combine the two and take into account the impact he's had on the game, I think he belongs in the Hall of Fame.
What I love between these two managers is, we're always talking about reaching younger people. We always talk about, hey, it's a young man's sport. Average age of these two managers?
69. One's a Dusty, 72. Snitker's 66.
Yeah.
How about Brian Snitker's been in the Braves organization for 45 years? I don't know that there's another living person who can say that. Minor league player to minor league coach to minor league manager, forever to major league coach to major league manager. 45 years with the Atlanta Braves. Like, again, these are two real feel-good stories.
Managers are not mandated to retire at any point in time, nor should they be. I wonder if you think Dusty might hang it up if they win a World Series this year.
That's a great question. I think Dusty loves being in the game. And although he would never say it, I do think he would love the attention that would come his way if he were to win the World Series. But I don't think whether they win game 7-2-1 or lose game 7-2-1 should make a difference in how he's evaluated. I thought Jim.
Well, I'm not suggesting that, Danny.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering whether at his age he feels like, okay, if I can win this, maybe that's a good way to go out.
Yeah, maybe. I think he loves being around people still. You know, I think he loves getting phone calls from old teammates talking about the game last night. Like, he references that kind of stuff in media sessions. What I don't know at all, and maybe I'll ask him today if we have a lull in the conversation. So his son, Darren, best known as the 3-year-old whose life got saved by JT Snow at home plate back in 2002. Well, little Darren is in the Washington Nationals organization right now. He was drafted in the 10th round last year, I believe, second baseman. I don't know how viable a major league prospect he is, but I don't know. Is he kicking around to see if he'd probably manage against him, not manage for him, right? They're on different teams right now. But I don't know. Dusty is a very... He was asked yesterday, your contract is up at the end of the year. How much do you think about getting an extension? And he totally, I mean, he just fly swatted it away. He said, man, I'm not thinking about that. I'm thinking about beating Atlanta here in game one tonight. He goes, I believe life has a way of sorting things out the way that they're meant to be sorted out. And he said, I've been okay before and I'll be okay again. Dusty does not lie awake at night worrying about himself.
Not if he's getting barbecue for the boys. That's for sure.
Well, do managers get too old? Is that even possible?
If they can relate to younger players and not if they are okay being analytically inclined.
I was going to say, they have to be receptive. They have to be receptive to change.
Yeah. Yeah. You know?
Because the game has changed.
Yeah.
Like recently.
And he is. I mean, if Dusty did everything exactly the way that he wanted to do it, it would be a little bit different than some of the things he does. I'm sure he does some of the things he does because it comes from above. But I think he gets a little more latitude. And really, the Astros, again, because of the situation they were in, they just wanted a guy who could put out the fire. And Dusty was the absolute best choice. The owner, Jim Crane, just a couple of days ago said, I believe Dusty has done enough to deserve another shot. I thought deserve another shot was kind of odd. I think Dusty's done a magnificent job for 2 years, and he deserves more than to be told he deserves another shot. He hasn't blown anything. I mean, he's been incredible for them the last couple of years, and I think if Dusty wants to come back, he should be able to come back.
Dan, you have been around professional sports long enough to know that owners don't always say the right thing.
Yeah, that's true. that's exactly right.
I'm sitting here trying to think of who is the oldest manager of our recollection. Now, Bobby Cox was up there.
Yeah.
Before he walked away. Wow. Did Bobby make it to 80?
No, I don't think so.
When he was still managing?
I do know this because I read it in the game notes yesterday that Dusty Baker, I think the last manager who was older to manage a team into the World Series was Jack McKeon of the 2003 Florida Marlins. Florida, he was a couple of years older.
Yeah.
But
that was an interim situation too, didn't
it? I think so, yeah.
He replaced someone midway through the season.
I think you're right. Yeah. I think you're right. So it's been that long, but it doesn't happen very often that somebody is in their 70s. But I'll tell you, he's a youthful, I think he's 72. He's really a cool, youthful 72. And I was told that when he first came in, the players were like, whoa, I don't know if this is a good fit. You know, A.J. Hinch, love him or hate him because of his involvement in the scandal, is in my opinion, a brilliant manager, a great manager. Like if I'm having a manager pool and I'm picking for my team, he's in the top three without question. Dusty is a very different guy just in terms of how old he is, his background, how he looks at things, the era that he played in. And I think some of the players were like, this is going to be a bit of an adjustment, but not that they had any choice. You know, they did what they did. They had to take what they take. But everybody has told me that within a couple of months, it wasn't overnight, but within a couple of months, they all warmed up to him a lot. And again, they know that he looks at them as people first and players second, and he likes to know what makes them tick.
There was a time when we believed, and I think it was true, that once the game started, and even before the game, the manager made the decisions. You know, there's the line in Moneyball where, you know, the manager sits
Art
there.
Art Howe.
Yeah. And says, you know, you get the players, I decide who plays and how they play, et cetera, et cetera. There is a consensus out there that that doesn't exist anymore, that the front office dictates decisions that are going to be made in the game before the game is played, and maybe even makes decisions during the game, and the manager is merely the conveyor of the information. Do you believe that's the case? And would Dusty care?
So I don't believe that is entirely the case. I think managers still make decisions. So there are things that happen in a game that you just can't account for. You just can't. So Morton gets hit on the leg, and now in the third inning, all of a sudden, Brian Snitker needs a reliever, and he brings in AJ Minter. And Minter pitches 2 2/3, I believe. He pitches the rest of the third inning and the fourth inning. 99% of the time, that guy's not coming out for his third inning of relief. But because Morton got hurt, they had to stretch him. Mm-hmm. Or they were going to wind up using one of their guys who was not in the circle of trust. To me, that is a decision that Brian Snitker made in the moment. So I still think there are decisions that are made in the moment, just not nearly as many. Front offices will tell you, we provide them with the information. They can use the information how they see it. I think that's a bit of a stretching of the truth. I think sometimes there is a, hey, we don't want to let McCown face that guy the third time through.
I wouldn't want McCown facing anybody anytime.
That's true. Well, he's not in a circle of trust. That's right.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I think there are some black and white situations where the front office might say he can't get to that spot at the third time through. But I think the managers are still making a lot of decisions along with the bench coach, along with the pitching coach. I think the bench coach is a subtly very important guy. I think he can play devil's advocate and he can say to the manager, well, think about this or think about that. So I do think some decisions are still happening in game.
One of the other things that was really interesting last night's game, and we'll conclude on this, and I'm going back to Morton here because you brought him up and I forgot to mention it. They were mentioning during the television broadcast last night of how Morton changed his delivery and essentially did it by looking at Doc Halliday. And how Halliday changed his arm angle significantly, and had so much success. And I thought that was very notable. And of course, I've heard that before, and I've watched Morton pitch enough that it wasn't a great surprise to me. But I was immediately focused on it, and it is really extraordinary how much Morton's delivery reminds you of Doc's.
Yeah, similar body type too. You know, big, tall right-hander, lanky, like. You know, Roy, especially when he came up as a kid, I mean, he was a beanpole, right? And he put some muscle on, obviously, but there were a lot of similarities. And Morton, again, is a very intelligent, introspective, thoughtful guy. And you know, I think he looked at his stuff and said, maybe that'll help me like it helped Roy Halliday. Because Roy Halliday, although, you know, he's a Hall of Famer, was not an instant success. He was anything but, was sent back down to A-ball, as we all remember. So that is a fascinating part of Morton's story to me. Another fascinating part is then he reinvented himself again, not in terms of his arm angle and his delivery, but in terms of the stuff he threw. For a while, he was known as Ground Chuck, a play on Charlie and also a play on getting ground balls, because he went Roy Halliday two-seam fastball, ground ball, ground ball, ground ball. Then he gets to Houston and the launch angle revolution has started. And the Astros are like, no, it's kind of high fastball, four seamer and curveball. And Charlie Morton changed his stuff. And now he throws both, but he throws the four seamer much more than the two seamer. And this kind of stuff fascinates me, that a guy who's almost 38 years of age can keep adjusting and reinventing himself as the times dictate it. And he has done it, in my opinion, better than any other older pitcher around to still be successful. He wasn't a star at 25.
Nope.
Like, you know, Verlander, Greinke, some of these other guys. But look at him now at 38 compared to some of the older pitchers. And I think he's done some very hard things without drawing attention to himself. And it's allowed him to have an incredible career.
It probably extended his career too.
Absolutely. You know, he said a few years ago, I only want to play. He was with Tampa Bay. He's a very family-oriented guy. They live somewhere in Central Florida. I'm not exactly sure. I believe in Central Florida. And he said, I only want to pitch for two teams, Tampa Bay and Atlanta. Who says that going into free agency? Who says the other 28?
Don't call.
We would all say drive up the price and then I'll go to it. Yeah. So he pitched for Tampa Bay and then he signed as a free agent with Atlanta. And now he signed an extension a few weeks ago with Atlanta, 1 year, $20 million. Good for him. We should all be, you know, we should all have such a tough market when we restricted to no two kidding. Teams, but he's a family man. Again, he's Marcus Semien. He's that guy. He's one of a handful of guys that even if you don't care about the team he's on, he's worth rooting for.
I know
John, we gotta go. We gotta go, John.
But quickly, Dick Vitale, your basketball buddy.
Yes.
How is he? What's going on?
He's doing well. The prognosis is good. Initially, the prognosis potentially was for something they weren't sure. So getting the news that it was lymphoma was actually something that he felt better about. I talked to him 2 days ago, and he's had his first 3-4 days of chemo. And he said, you know, it knocked him out but no nausea or anything like that. He's been sleeping a lot. He is planning on working this year. They've told him they think that's possible. Once they get him into the routine, they can work around his work schedule. But to no one's surprise, he's a scrapper. He's a fighter. And the prognosis is very good. So for that, we're all very grateful.
When you're talking to him, send him our best, please.
Will do.
And thank you very much for your time. Glad you're safe. And the weather hopefully improves.
I hope so.
One game in a World Series doesn't mean anything. But that was pretty interesting last night. Thank you, Danny Boy.
Thanks, guys. Be well.
Dan Shulman. We'll come back to wrap it after these. And we are back. Our thanks to Dan Shulman for joining us.
Hey, Bob, one quick thing. We talked about the Blackhawk scenario at the top of the show. Joel Quenneville is meeting in New York with Gary Bettman tomorrow.
Right. And I assume Shovel Day Off will be
very soon, I assume. Yeah.
Probably the next day.
Yeah.
Blackhawks and the Maple Leafs tonight. Leafs lose to the Blackhawks tonight. Does all panic ensue?
Well, more panic ensues, but I'm not sure what you can do. And then the next step is they play Detroit on Saturday. And, you know, and these are teams that when you look at the schedule, the Maple Leafs have been saying they should be able to put W's beside. And if they
easy
can't put,
W's, not just W's, but well, you but, have easy.
Yeah. Wins. Yeah. And if they can't be putting W's beside games against Chicago and Detroit, then panic will ensue and panic might just be deserved.
And perhaps change will
That's an interesting take place. One. That's an interesting one.
Well, I said perhaps. I'm not predicting it, but...
With the turmoil going on above, you wonder if that's even possible.
That's a question I cannot answer either.
Right.
We got to get out of here. So a hockey game tonight, a baseball game tonight, and we'll find something to talk about tomorrow. Mm. We hope y'all come back. For John Shannon, Bob McCowan, that's it for us. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow. Goodbye, everybody.